Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on KKOA 107.7 FM or at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Or to the podcast at lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Now here's your host and producer, Sherry Brackett.
Aloha, welcome to Island Issues. Today we have more discussions coming out of the Puna 2018 lava flow with Hawaii County Prosecutor Mitch Roth, Hawaii County Civil Defense Director Talmadge Magno, and Susie Osborne, head of school at Kuaokala Public Charter School in Kapoho, about the fate of the school and of her personal residence. Let's get to it. Good morning, Aloha County Prosecutor Mitch Roth.
Aloha, Sherry.
Mitch, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with us. There's a lot of legal issues surrounding the lava flow that I wanted to clear up with you. And as we record this on Thursday, May 31st, we today have received a mandatory evacuation order from Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim, saying that everybody in Leilani Estates east of Pomaikai Street must evacuate within 24 hours. There's still a lot of people going into areas that, according to the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, are very much threatened. Do we understand why this mandatory evacuation order was issued just for this particular area?
There's actually two different orders. One's actually an order. There's also rules that just came out as well for the lower area of Kapoho vacation land and maybe one or two other areas down there. The area in Leilani Estates is extremely dangerous. And you know that we had the other night a situation where you had first responders out there having to perform rescues. It's just an area that's too dangerous to even be into.
A lot of people are very happy that the mandatory evacuation order is given just for that reason. Nobody wants to see our first responders forced to go in to rescue people who probably should not be in an area that's really hazardous. The first responders are then themselves at risk.
We're very concerned with the first responders, whether they be police, fire, National Guard, or public works, or DLNR, DOCARE officers.
The civil defense alert that came out after the mandatory evacuation order and after that emergency rule said that people can continue to go into Leilani Estates if they have proper ID and placards. So it feels like it's still a very loose evacuation order. Or is it really mandatory? Because that's been a point of confusion. People are told to be prepared to evacuate. They're urged to evacuate. But as long as they're there, our first responders can be at risk.
The mandatory evacuation order, that is for a limited area where there's a lot of activity right now. I understand what the mayor was doing. He wanted to give people as much normalcy in their lives. Now it's just getting a little bit too dangerous. It's an active volcano.
Can people refuse to evacuate even if there is a mandatory order? Can they just say no?
If they're in this area, they will be arrested, is my understanding. So, you know, talking to the police, we will be enforcing the law. We'll be prosecuting to the fullest extent.
If people do not evacuate, whether it's a voluntary or mandatory evacuation order, particularly if it's a mandatory order, does the government, do the first responders have an obligation to rescue them?
You know, that's an interesting question. These guys feel that their job is to save lives, and that's exactly what they've been trying to do. Do they have an obligation to put their own lives at risk is probably a better question. I think the answer is no. You know, we saw the other night that was kind of where we were. The lava was moving really quickly, and you had people that were in the area that should have left. We had people going above and beyond to make sure that they were safe.
I think our first responders would always help if they can. I think there's no question about that. But, of course, it puts them in a pretty awkward position if somebody calls 911 and says, yeah, I'm not where I should be, but now I need help. It's going to be really hard for our teams, all teams, military, fire, police. It's going to be difficult for them to not go in, although the fire chief did tell me that he does not want his teams to go in if it is deemed too dangerous and at risk of them losing their own lives.
Right. Yeah, I was in the EOC when a lot of this was happening. There's a lot of pieces that are moving, including looking at Facebook posts and things like that where people were telling these people that, oh, the helicopters are coming in to rescue you. And we were sitting in there saying there's no way a helicopter is going in at night into an area with an active lava flow to rescue these guys. It wouldn't have been safe for the helicopters. They didn't go in with helicopters. They had to go in by foot. But there's a lot of misleading information that the general public has been putting out, and even some news stations.
I don't disagree. I've seen that. People do need to listen to the official sources.
Correct. You know, having been in the EOC watching what's happening, I can tell you these people are doing everything they can to make sure people are safe.
I know the civil defense folks, Talmadge Magno and his team, I know they are all focused on keeping people safe. And I know you cannot speak for another person, but why doesn't the mayor just issue a mandatory evacuation order for these areas that seem to be very much at risk? Isn't it better to evacuate folks rather than have to rescue folks?
I can't answer for the mayor. We're learning as we go.
You talked about prosecution.
We have a couple of those cases where people are loitering in the area that should not be in the area. The rules have come out. The proclamation has come out telling them they shouldn't be in that area. So we are going forward with prosecution on those cases. There's a couple of different ways we can prosecute. One is under the Hawaii State Statute 127A. There's also a county rule for loitering in the area. We're looking at those things for the thefts and for other kinds of crimes. There are some penalties that get bumped up to be a lot more serious. We want to make a point that we're not going to tolerate people violating the laws in these areas. And we're going to be as serious about these cases as we can. And we're going to look for any way we can to make the point that these are serious crimes and we're going to prosecute to the fullest extent of the law, whether that means we're going to prosecute you in state court, federal court, or both. We're actually working with the U.S. attorney on a couple of cases now to see which has the biggest hammer, whether it's going to be state, federal, or both.
What kind of cases are they?
We've had some incidents with drones that possibly put in danger our helicopter pilots and passengers. We're starting to see possible disaster fraud and a little bit of local stuff, but there's also federal disaster fraud possibilities. We have a couple of cases. We've seen what felony offenses can be charged, and there's a extended term for having a couple or more felonies. If it's a Class A felony, that extended term could be more than 20 years, could be up to life imprisonment with the possibility of parole for a Class A felony. For burglary cases, we're looking at burglary during an emergency period. That's a Class A felony now rather than a Class B felony. So it goes from a 10-year possibility of incarceration to a 20-year possibility of incarceration. If you have a couple of crimes that you're getting charged with, we'll charge the extended, which will make it life with the possibility of parole. We're treating this very seriously.
When you talked about emergency situation fraud, what are you talking about?
Filing false claims. Those be FEMA or otherwise, and people who have gone on the internet and tried to rent out houses that they don't own, taking advantage of people who are in a desperate situation.
That was my conversation with Hawaii County Prosecutor Mitch Roth, recorded last Thursday. Now I'm talking with Talmadge Magno. He's the director of Hawaii County Civil Defense, and it's Saturday morning, just after 10 a.m. Good morning. Aloha, Talmadge.
Good morning, Sherry.
I want to ask you about the mandatory evacuation order that was issued on Thursday to have everybody out by Friday at noon. How did it work out for everybody?
I guess it worked fine. I know there's some people complaining, but, you know, like last night we lost a couple more houses in that area under the mandatory evacuation, you know, so it's those kind of situations that we don't have to really worry about now.
Of course, I read in the Star Advertiser this morning that there were emergency evacuations being conducted overnight by fire department. What was that all about?
It started yesterday afternoon, and it was conducted by police, civil defense, public works, and fire department for the areas of Vacation Land, Kapoho, Papaya Farms Road, Highway 132, Noni Farms Road, the old railroad area. It's all those areas where the flows are traveling to now. Not what we had in Leilani. It was fissures opening up and adjacent flows to the fissures.
The mandatory evacuation order said the county might not rescue folks, or if they do, they might charge for that. How is that actually, practically speaking, going to work? Because we know if there's a 911 call, emergency responders, you know, that's what they do. That's their mission. They respond. So how is that going to be addressed? Because we never want to see our first responders in danger if you've already told folks to get out.
Right. That's exactly what it provides. We had successive nights, three nights in a row, where fast-moving flows would break out and go into the subdivision, into areas that are now within that mandatory evacuation area into streets that we had to go down door to door to get people out, some people refusing to get out, some people becoming entrapped. And so firefighters, other personnel were in there at night risking their lives to save people that should have been out of that area. That's what we're trying to avoid. Our firefighters, our public works, our police, our civil defense staff, getting in there, getting in a situation that you get overtaken by lava.
Is the county actually going to refuse to do rescues?
We'll have to. If it's such a situation that you probably end up injuring yourself or getting someone killed, we're going to have to.
There was one example, a Leilani Estates resident who'd been on the news several times saying how he was going to stay in his home until his life was threatened. And then the Tribune Herald reported Saturday, today, that this man who had chosen to stay called 911 and asked for a helicopter to pick him up, sort of like you'd call Uber or a cab. And he did not get that. It was too dangerous, and he was guided out by drone. But Talmadge, why doesn't the county just tell people they have to be out of all these areas?
We did. We put down a mandatory evacuation order with the possibility of arrest. Just as in hurricanes, you know, if you don't want to leave, or even tsunamis, if you don't want to leave, that is your choice. If you go into Leilani Estates, when you enter through Leilani Boulevard, up until you get to a certain point, you wouldn't even know that an eruption is going on. But once you get into that area, the impacted area, then you definitely know it's not the same subdivision that existed there a month ago.
Kapoho areas, vacation land, people are supposed to be out of there. Those areas are not mandatory evacuation, but it sounds like that's very threatened.
Yes, it is. We went door to door the last few days. As of this morning, the lava has crossed the road near Four Corners, so 137 is blocked. Those people that are in there, we know there is a few people that elected to remain in there. They are now isolated.
Different topic completely. There are still a lot of people, around 400 to 450, I believe, at the last count, staying at the community centers. And of course, that's not the best place to live. In other disasters, FEMA has brought in trailers and such for immediate emergency housing. Is there any plan that FEMA or any other agency has to bring in more acceptable living spaces?
Well, when you talk about immediately, you're talking about the continental United States. So we don't have that immediate connection, but we are talking about interim housing, temporary, quickly built one-room facilities that are put on non-government or government property. That's in the plans right now, as well as planning of possible new development in the Puna district for relocation.
I'm talking more about FEMA and the trailers, for example, that they've used in different hurricanes. And it's been a month now into this disaster, and it takes about a week or two for something to come over by container ship. Is FEMA thinking of bringing in something for immediate? Because I know that HPM is working hard to build these tiny houses, they're calling them, and that's going to be a good thing, but it'll be a little bit before they're done. What about FEMA's participation in this?
FEMA is here, but we're not talking about trailers.
Mayor Harry Kim said on Friday he is planning on building some kind of new village to house folks. Do you have any details on that, where it actually is going to be, how it'll be funded?
We're looking at several options, whether it'll be from a private group or government lands. Still yet to be decided, but we've been meeting to discuss that, what would fall into current growth or current plans with other developments on the books. So all that's being considered. FEMA, state, county are involved. Planning, building, housing, civil defense are all participating in the discussion. As far as funding, we talked to the state legislature folks last night. They might have a possible special session to discuss this. FEMA's on the ground, and we're looking at what they could provide for this kind of a program. Also, see if there's any private monies that could go through some kind of development.
Talmadge Magno, anything else you'd like to add?
I'm really thankful for not just the Puna community, but the island-wide community support for what's going on here. I realize that it's just a small point on this island that's impacted. But, I see the impact island-wide as far as the economy, as far as tourism, and definitely the ash and gas increase that's impacting pretty much island-wide. Appreciate everybody's concerns. and help and good ideas and support for these people in Puna.
And just a reminder, this is Island Issues. We're on Koa Country every Sunday morning at 6:30 a.m. And at 8 a.m. we're on Lava 105.3 FM. And then you may listen to these interviews as podcasts at lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bracken. Let's get to our next conversation. Among the residents and businesses being threatened by the lava flow is Kuu'okalā Public Charter School, and we're going to start by rebroadcasting a portion of an interview I did about Kuu'okalā Public Charter School back in 2012, and we're going to follow it up with a recent conversation with Susie Osborne, head of school. But let's first take a look at the 2012 interview. I'm talking with several people from Kuu'okalā Public Charter School today, Principal Susie Osborne, and I'm also with Ryan McCormick. He's a teacher. Susie, remind us, what exactly is a charter school?
Charter school is a public school. Initially, we were formed about 12 years ago to be places of innovation for our public school system.
Okay, now you mentioned public school. Does that mean that any child can come here to Kuu'okalā?
That's correct. Most charter schools are mission-driven, so we meet with all the families and the children prior to their coming to school and talk story about our mission and vision and to make sure that it's a right fit. Any child is welcome to join us. This is our 10th year. We started very small with about 26 children in grades 6 through 8. We added a grade every year until we hit grade 12 and decided that we needed to start earlier. So at that point, we started K-1, and now we are K-12 with 188 students. We also have a hybrid virtual program integrated within our school. And it's good.
Funding, that's an area of curiosity for me, because I know here on Hawaii Island, we actually have more charter schools than any other place in the state. And they are public schools, but are they not funded just like a standard public school? What's the funding situation from the Department of Education?
We're funded by a per pupil allotment. So every child that comes, we receive a certain amount of money. It used to be $8,000. Now we're a little over $5,000, and we just learned we're going to get less next year. There's many challenges. We don't receive any money for facilities or transportation, and especially in Pune, you see where we are. We're quite rural. We transport all the way from Hilo, so we, in fact, bought our own buses, and we have to pay for our bus driver, pay for the exorbitant fuel costs, build our facilities, and make do with the $5,000 to run a school per pupil. So many studies have been done, and the state continues to try to address the equity issue.
If your funding is, you said, $5,000 per pupil, what is the funding for a student at any other public school here in the state of Hawaii?
It's about $12,000.
I understand that you actually are the founder of this school as well. So just talk a little bit about where this all came from, because you're really located in a very special place. You're right next to the Kapoho Hot Ponds. You're pretty much at the end of the road, and it's beautiful. But how did you come to found this school?
My partner of the last 20 years was working with Challenge Native Hawaiian Youth through the Hawaii Opio Ho'omaikai program and was always coming down here even before the park next door, Ahala Nui Park and Mauna Kea Warm Pond, existed as a public facility. There was a desecration that occurred in this village. We're sitting on 600 acres here, 40 of which is one of the most intact ancient Hawaiian villages that remains today. So he found that he is in fact a lineal descendant to this place. Kamehameha Schools is the recognized landowner. Worked with them, and we formed our nonprofit Ho'oululahui, which means to nurture and perpetuate a nation, specifically our Native Hawaiian nation. And we began working with the public schools, the private schools, did a lot of work with the prisoners, mental health organizations, any places where there was a high percentage of Native Hawaiians. And as we began to stabilize the village, we had the state archaeologists volunteer 2 days a week for 4 years, mapping the village and working with children in Pahoa School that were kicked out and not allowed on campus. When they came down and they were doing projects that had cultural relevance and meaningful science work by doing the archaeology, I really saw the lights go on in these children's eyes. And they, in fact, were producing university-level documents that are still logged in with the state today. 8 years later, the legislation came through for charter schools, and we got a call from Dr. Kuka Hakalau, who was the founder of Kanua Ka'aina, and invited us up for dinner and said, you know, I think we really need to offer a choice in education for our Native Hawaiian community. At that time, people could actually go out on field trips as opposed to just putting all your attention on math and English, which is what's been happening in the last few years. And we were servicing thousands of kids through here. So it seemed like a very big task, one that I wasn't really that interested in. until one day a very tired special education teacher came along and came up to me and said, "What are you doing with those lazy, no good for nothing Hawaiians," that sort of attitude. And I realized, I think we need a choice for our children. So we took the plunge and wrote our detailed implementation plan. And then we took an extra year of planning because while we have 600 acres, we had no facilities. Fortunately, Opiikau Church, Pastor John Makuakane, allowed us the use of the facility. We house our kindergarten there. We began very small, and my thinking and my motto was small, strong, and successful, and let's grow up together and build the school together. And I think that that's what we've done.
Tell us about your curriculum and the extent to which you do include subjects like math and science and those things which are considered fairly standard.
Well, I think you've hit upon a big challenge area and one we continue to struggle with and have really healthy discussions around, because as a public school, we are mandated to meet our content standards and address all content areas for our children. But we are a Hawaiian culturally driven school. Half of the charters are Hawaiian culturally driven, some of which are immersion, meaning their medium of instruction is through the Hawaiian language, and half of our schools are culturally driven. So as often and as much as we can through the lens of Hawaiian culture, this is getting to be more and more of a challenge with all the compliance issues placed upon us. How do we do both? How do we do both very well? And how do we not lose our mission, vision, and our heart that we really believe that especially the medium of Hawaiian language and Hawaiian cultural practices is a very important thing that not only do we need to perpetuate, but that is an avenue of engagement for our children. And I would like Ryan to speak with this also.
Currently, I teach 9th and 10th grade social studies, which covers Hawaiian history and American history. I also teach geometry, and I also teach hula, and I teach Hawaiian language as well. And that's really where my passions lie. Like Susie has mentioned, compliance has become a big onus for us here in charter schools, so we have to wear many hats. That's okay.
Do the kids still get what I would call are some of the standard subjects? Do they get math? Do they get science? Do they get English?
Yeah, definitely. At this point in time, our curriculum is primarily akin to that of a traditional school. We spend our regular time in math class and our regular time in reading and English classes. Science and social studies are kind of the subject areas where we can integrate a little bit more and make use of the wonderful natural resources that we have around us here. We're situated right in the middle of a coastal rainforest. We've got archaeological sites. We have very significant cultural sites in the area. So as much as possible, we try to attach the projects and incorporate the content areas that we're talking about in social studies with those things as well.
Susie, I don't want to leave the subject of funding without finding out where else you get funding from, because I am pretty clear that you get a minimum amount of funding from the state, which is important, but are there other funding sources for you?
Yes, currently, in fact, just to really simplify and show how dire the need is, the amount of money that we get from the state is actually $4,000 less than we need to, in fact, just cover payroll alone. So I raise about $600,000 to just operate the school, some of which we're very blessed comes from Kamehameha Schools, are supporting the Hawaiian charter schools, and the others I just write grants. And let's hope we get some of them, some for programmatic, but also for the infrastructure. We have a certified cafeteria, kitchen, and composting toilet complex. While you see classrooms here, there's no lua toilets or water on this side. And so we're in dire need of that. Yes, funding is a challenge.
You are out here in a little bit of a remote area of Puna. Where are your students from?
As a charter school, you do not have any geographic limitations. We actually bus all the way from Hilo, and we have some kids even coming from Volcano as well. With our hybrid virtual, we're taking care of some students in Na'alehu that don't have access or their education is not working for them. And we're also in the process of talking to our Mililii community that is very, very remote, and they have a massive percentage of dropout with their Hawaiian children. So we really want to take care of that community. So we're excited. Some of the schools now are having distance learning programs that are done on computer. Our research has shown that in order to really be successful with that, you need to have what's called a hybrid program. We have a site in Hilo where we have a certified teacher there every day, and out here in Puna, that the kids are able to come on site every day if they want to. If they're not able to, they don't have to. They're not mandated. But we have electives, and we also have teacher availability at all times for them.
It sounds like you wrap a lot of the learning around the Hawaiian culture.
We bring in community cultural practitioners and artists and people who bring their talent to the school and allow our kids to explore many of their other intelligences. But in addition to that, I also incorporate the teaching of hula and Hawaiian chant and song and music in general into our investigation of Hawaiian and American history. And I like to use music and the development of music as a lens to look at how those two cultures have interacted over time. There's a lot of kids here that are really skilled at music and really interested in music, so I think it's provided a way for them to root their interest in music in history. We also use Hawaiian protocols. We use chant as a way to sort of contextualize the daily learning experience in a much more Native Hawaiian perspective.
What's the ethnic background of your students? Are they all Native Hawaiian or is there a mix?
I would say that it matches fairly well the demographics of Puna itself. So it's definitely mixed between Native Hawaiian, part Hawaiian. Some students have just arrived here and this is their first experience in Hawaii. And then a lot of local kids who've been here their whole lives.
And that was an excerpt from an interview I did in 2012 at and about Kuʻokala Public Charter School. The school is threatened. A lava flow has stopped right behind it. I spoke with Susie Osborne to get an update.
One of the fissures opened up again and had multiple fingers rushing down towards Kapoho area. Many were evacuated in the middle of the night. And another finger reactivated, heading down towards Pualaʻa, our 600-acre site that our nonprofit Hoʻoulu Lahui has. And then, of course, there's Ahalanui County Park. So it's really hard to say where it's going to go. It's getting way too close for comfort. We're just prayerful, watchful, and have faith that our beautiful, special piko, the piko of our school site, will be intact for us to return to someday.
Well, what about all the furnishings, the books, the materials that you had in the school? Is that all in the school right now?
I got a call from Civil Defense early in the morning saying there was a finger heading that way, which stalled out. But we had Highways Division and all sorts of community members come in just showing so much aloha and good spirit, and it helped us move a lot of the equipment out. We've done our best, and at this point, it is what it is.
How many students do you have enrolled in the school as of a month ago?
Well, we service pre-K through 12, and we have 230 students, 50 to 60% that have had to evacuate. Many have lost their homes, such as myself. That includes some of our amazing staff who have been just so resilient and persevering through this difficult time. I have an amazing principal. I'm head of school. Between all of us, we rallied up very quickly as Puna people moved, just with great resilience, and we secured the Boys and Girls Club in Hilo for our middle and high school, and the New Hope Church. They've both been just so gracious and unbelievably generous to us, and that's been for our kindergarten through grade 6. We've relocated the students there. The students are just so happy to be together and showing so much aloha and thankfulness for each other. As difficult as this moment is, which it absolutely is for all of us, I have to say that our foundational values of our school as a Hawaiian-focused charter school of aloha, malama, kokua, kulia, and mahalo are just exemplified on a day-to-day basis, and we instill this on every level of the school and the children. And this is an opportunity for all of us to deeply live these values and understand that they are a key part of our toolbox in life. So today we had our final day celebration and had our Ailike, our values awards, and came together and celebrated each other and the school, and the school continues on with great solidarity.
So are you out for summer vacation now?
The kids and the teachers are. Our amazing admin team, we will be hard at work. Part of that will be, you know, ensuring that we let the community know that we are going to be in Hilo for next year, but we'll bus our students from Puna area, and we will absolutely expand our support systems as deeply and profoundly as we can for our families with the greatest aloha that we can. So we'll be working hard to get ready for next year and to let people know that we're open.
Next year you will be in the locations in Hilo that you mentioned. That's a set thing, and Kuʻokala can continue to use those facilities?
We're just finalizing agreements, and we're really hopeful that that's what will happen. It's not pa'a yet, but we're talking stories with both entities and really pray that this will be, because they're just perfect facilities for the children, and that's what it's all about, coming together, helping our community, and especially our children, the future generation. We have to take care of them. It's a really traumatic time for the children. I know it's been super difficult for me, so I can only imagine for our children. So they really need that stable support, and facilities is a really huge part of that. So we hope and pray that that's what will happen. I think it's important to understand that while Kualoa is physically impacted, all of our East Hawaii schools are feeling this. All of our children live in these communities. All of our staff and students and parents have had to evacuate and are in the shelters or on someone's couch like I was for 3 weeks. It's not just a Kualoa thing. This is a really massive issue with widespread impact that is just devastating. It's really a challenging moment.
One of the things we talked about in 2012 was the fact that charter schools in general, including yours, do not get the kind of funding from the State Department of Education that a standard public school does, even though charter schools are public schools. Now, at this point, you are going to need additional funding, I would imagine, to be able to pull all this off. And I'm wondering if the Department of Education has had any communication with you, because I think you're the only school at this point that has been most directly impacted by having to actually leave your facility. So tell us how the finances are going to be worked out, if you know.
Well, I think there's a short-term, mid-term, and long-range visions and goals that we have to have. We are not directly under the Department of Education. We're more under the Board of Education, but our immediate authority is the Charter School Commission. They've recently completed a strategic plan. They have been in communication with us and have ensured that any sort of relocation and immediate needs and support that we have are taken care of. I'm in discussion with them about next year, say the next 2 years, a stabilization plan, because there are no emergency funds in the charter school budget. And this has been an ongoing concern with the other public schools. It's just, you know, there's no problem if they lose students, but we're funded on a per pupil basis. And if we have sort of a mass exodus in our community, and especially as a small school, it's crippling. So I actually presented at the Board of Education last week to say it's imperative at this time that whatever the mechanism is, which I think requires the governor's support to ensure some stabilization funding for not only my school, but the East Hawaii Charter School, so that we can ensure that we continue to provide the support and we're able to be open, you know, while we sort of recover. And then, you know, hopefully we don't lose our campus, but at this moment it's looking very scary. I'm feeling a lot more confident than I was a few years ago. The culture and the climate and the support systems for charter school are very different under the leadership of Sione Thompson, our executive director, and our Charter School Commission board. I think that they'll be very responsive, but it's just a matter of the mechanisms and how, especially not having that in a budget, which is ridiculous. As you said, these are all public school children.
Before we leave Kualoa, is there anything else we should know about the current situation with Kualoa Public Charter School?
That we're just a loving, wonderful, amazing Hawaiian-focused charter school founded in our values, as I said, and that we will be open next year and accepting enrollment now and really welcome our families. We're small, but just loving, intimate school. I love my school, and I love our staff and an amazing principal, a couple of offices. We're just a great team.
How do people find out more about Kualoa Public Charter School?
Our website, kualoa.org. That is probably the best way right now.
Susie Osborne, Leilani Estates was where your home was.
I was actually probably the first person to see the lava erupt because I live on Mohala Street, Fisher 1, and I was actually walking out on the streets to see these cracks that were emerging, and there were some county workers there, and we all kind of looked up at the same time at the kitty corner from my property across the street and saw this little explosion, and somebody was screaming, "Get out, get out," and I just jumped in my truck and left. I wasn't able to get my cats or anything. It didn't take my home at that time. I was able to go back and get some things. I got one of my 3 cats, and unfortunately I'm quite sure the others are no longer with us given how the lava flowed. But on graduation day, I went in the morning, May 25th, to check on my home before graduation and do some pule, and was really happy that my home was there and had a wonderful, beautiful graduation. Sometime later after graduation, learned that my home was no longer there. As most homes do, it caught fire and burned, and then the lava came.
You know, Governor Ige even made a point of that at one of the first community meetings, that the way things go is the lava generates so much heat ahead of its arrival that homes typically catch on fire even if the lava doesn't overrun them. What's your situation with homeowners insurance?
My insurance is Lloyd's of London that is not regulated by the state, and I have felt very misled and tried not to be angry through this time. The agent told me, well, this isn't covered. So I'm in great distress right now because it was, you know, all my assets and resources in my home. And I know that it's just standard that the home, it gets so hot from the lava that it burns in advance. And it's distressing that it's something that I would have to prove because I do have fire insurance. I'm now putting out the call if anyone has any photos or aerials of Mohalla Street in the afternoon of the 25th to see if I can secure some information, but it's just actually ridiculous that someone has to do that. It's very distressing on top of everything to have to deal with an insurance company in this manner. It's really heartbreaking.
Do you have a place to live right now?
Through the generosity of some friends, I managed to find a little place. But I'm really grateful that I'm not bothering my friend on her couch any longer, and I'm not in a shelter as many of my families are. Now I feel that it's time for me to really focus my attention on what more can I do to stretch out and start to help my community.
And that was Susie Osborne, head of school for Kuu'okalā Public Charter School. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken, your host and producer. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues, brought to you by Regency at Hualalai, a retirement and assisted living community. Join us again next week for another Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.